their future state.
We are here to support Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's part of our faith and we are willing to sacrifice our lives in order to protect it. Gaza will always defend Al-Quds and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to protect Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
Palestinians say they will use all forms of resistance to protect Al-Aqsa Mosque and the holy city of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Tehran has hosted the fifth conference in solidarity with the Palestinian children and the youth. The event is held every year on the occasion of the martyrdom of 12-year-old Palestinian Mohammed al-Dur and other martyrs of Palestinian children and the youth. The event highlights the ongoing plight of those born under Israeli occupation and blockade. Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes.
All Muslims are duty-bound to fight against the Zionist regime in an effort to maintain peace and stability in the Islamic world and the region, and stand firmly against the expansionism and aggressive policies of Israel.
Mohammed al-Dur was martyred in the Gaza Strip on September 30, 2000, on this Jamal al-Dur and his 12-year-old son Mohammed were filmed by a Palestinian cameraman as Israeli forces fired bullets at them.
Israeli forces shot dead Mohammed al-Dura in his father's arms, but unfortunately the murderer enjoys support from his Western backers. The regime relieves itself from any responsibility for the support it receives from some governments, communities and international organizations. That's why it exerts organized violence against Palestinian society, especially children and the youth.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged three wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children. According to the Palestinian Prisoner Society, the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. 19,000 minors, including children younger than 10 years of age, had been arrested since the outbreak of the Second Intifada back in September 2000.
To Palestinians, martyrdom of 12-year-old Mohammed al-Dur has become a symbol of resistance, which Palestinians believe is the only solution to put an end to Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Saman Kujur, Tehran.
The farmers from Pakistan's most significant agriculture province of Punjab have been staging a sit-in since last week. The protest action is against the imposition of agrarian taxes and the increase of electricity tariffs by the government, which they say have badly hit their income.
The farmers who have been protesting since last week in Islamabad's Blue Area are asking the government to waive the taxes recently imposed on tube-well electricity and agriculture fertilizers.
Farmers are the backbone of the country's economy. We are demanding the restoration of the previous tube-well electricity tariff of ₹5.3 per unit and abolishment of all the taxes recently levied, as well as the other adjustments made by the government.
The farmers have warned that they will block off the main roads countrywide if their demands are not accommodated. They are also seeking an end to what they call black marketing of fertilizers and reduction of urea rate, which has risen to 400% in recent days.
The rates of urea and other key agricultural fertilizers have gone up in recent months. We cannot afford costs of harvesting our crops in such conditions. We demand relief funds from the government for the agricultural sector.
The government considers agriculture a provincial subject, so it refrains from addressing farmers' major issues. However, authorities are in contact with the relevant stakeholders to alleviate the farmers' concerns. The devastating floods, which have left more than 1,600 Pakistanis dead and displaced over 33 million people, have added to Pakistan's forex woes with an estimated economic loss of over $30 billion. Although the International Monetary Fund recently agreed to release over $1.17 billion in funds to Pakistan, the economic situation remains precarious in flood-hit country. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The High School of Human Sciences Leonardo da Vinci is located in central Rome, not far from the Colosseum. The school has a good reputation. It offers a mix of classical and modern studies and a cultural background which, reads its website, allows pupils to access any university faculty. However, earlier this week, one of Leonardo da Vinci's teachers cut a lock of hair from an Iranian student after urging her to express solidarity with the protests taking place in Iran. The underage girl had remained unresponsive to the teacher's request.
We were shocked at the teacher's behavior. It targeted an Iranian minor because of her nationality and made the student feel that expressing solidarity was an act due for her. An act of exclusion from the class was then turned into an act of violence when the teacher humiliated the student by cutting a lock of her hair.
The teacher was addressing his pupils on the issue of protests in Iran that have been going on for days after the tragic death of 22-year-old girl Mahsa Amini. She politely refused to be interviewed, saying that Italy's education authority has forbidden all school staff from engaging with the media on the issue. The teacher involved in the case risks now a disciplinary sanction. Even the mayor of Rome, Roberto Gualtieri, has said the episode concerning the Iranian student, if confirmed, would be an unacceptable form of bullying.
For sure there was violence in the way the teacher behaved. The whole story revolves around someone who has been bullied and their attacker. In between were the other students stunned, petrified, because of the teacher's gesture. They suddenly acted as if they were attendants. They were passive, resigned, a common attitude in our society.
The fact that a teacher, who is someone who should encourage free thinking and the natural reflection of wanting to do something for oneself, I don't know, I think it was absolutely unnecessary and they should definitely face some consequences.
Also, the National Association of Principals of Rome has condemned the teacher's gesture, saying that teachers should always act with great caution and that principals must ensure that schools are a place of growth and not a place where one looks for media exposure. Max Civili, Rome.
Another black day for the residents of the west of Kabul. Today morning, a bomb hit the Qaj Educational Center in Dasht-e-Barchi area in Shia Hazara neighborhoods. The students were sitting a practice university exam when the explosion went off. The victims of the incident were taken to the hospital. Their relatives report a high number of casualties.
My sister and my cousin were brought here to the emergency hospital. They are now in critical health conditions. They were at the educational center for their exams. As I witnessed, the victims were all innocent people. I saw nearly 60 to 70 people dead and wounded in one individual hospital.
Terrified Muhammad Issa has brought his wounded niece to this hospital. He calls on the Taliban and the global community to do something to help get rid of such attacks.
I saw a lot of people killed or injured. It was very shocking. I visited the educational center. Scores of bodies were laid on the floor. People are terrified. I don't know why there is no end to our suffering. They attack us everywhere. Till when? I call on the global community to do something for the situation of Afghan people, especially Hazaras.
Here, Taliban security officials are visiting the site of the explosion. They say they will take all necessary steps for tightening security for all.
Islamic Emirate is watchful for the security of the people, especially in western Kabul. I promise that everything will come under our control and such incidents won't happen in the future. Such attacks on innocent students are carried out by the enemies of Islam and the people of Afghanistan.
Mosques and educational centers in Shia Hazara neighborhoods in Kabul have been the target of terrorist attacks for years. the Daesh terrorist group, have claimed responsibility for most of such attacks. People here in western Kabul say the seemingly endless violence has exhausted them. They want peace, security, and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For many years, the people of Donbas have been waiting for this historic day, which was preceded by a bloody war in the east of Ukraine that led to the intervention of the Russian army to save the Lugansk and Donetsk people from genocide. Despite Western pressure, the Russian president did not hesitate to accept the request of four regions of eastern Ukraine to join the Federation through a referendum described as successful by authorities in those regions. Central Election Committee representatives reported that those who took part in the votes decided overwhelmingly in favor of the accession to Russia.
The unbroken people of Donbas, Zaporizhia and Kherson said the word. I want the authorities in Kyiv and the real masters in the West to hear me, and I want everyone to remember this. People living in DPR, LPR, Kherson and Zaporizhia have become our citizens forever.
In a ceremony attended by the heads of Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson and Zaporozhye regions, Vladimir Putin signed a decree for the formal accession of the former Ukrainian territories controlled by the Russian army over the past months. As a result, the four regions became part of the Russian Federation, which is now obliged to protect them from any aggression under the constitution and the Russian military doctrine.
Today we are fighting for a just and free path. First of all, for ourselves, for Russia, for diktat, despotism to remain forever in the past. I am convinced that countries and peoples understand that a policy based on exclusivity of anyone, on the suppression of other cultures and peoples, is inherently criminal, that we must turn this shameful page. The collapse of Western hegemony that has begun is irreversible. And I repeat again, it will not be the same as before.
Our country is taking back its historical lands that our grandfathers defended. I am inspired that I caught and I am a participant of this moment. These territories and our people were artificially divided.
The West, led by the United States, has been supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine, sending large numbers of mercenaries to the country, and imposing huge economic sanctions against Russia. But it has failed to stop Moscow's special military operation in Ukraine. And for the Donbas, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, which have been fighting for their right to become part of Russia, the accession means, first of all, security and sustainable economic development for them.
The right and decision of the four regions to join Russia is undoubtedly a historical moment. Moscow says strikes by Ukraine on those territories joining Russia today will be seen as an act of aggression against the state. It has vowed to protect the territories at all cost after the accession to Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for arising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei has spoken for the first time after the recent riots that broke out in Iran. He was very clear about one thing. The violent riots in Iran were planned by the U.S. and the Zionist regime in reference to Israel. The capacity of the Iranian armed forces, the leader was surprised how many had not observed the rioting to have its origins stemming from plots hatched by the U.S. and Israel. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the statements of Iran's leader and dissect what he has described as one of the main motivations of the U.S. and Israel, which is to prevent a strong and independent Iran, including the country's progress. Our guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight are Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, who joins us from Madison. Also joining us is Brent Yonkers, historian and journalist, who joins us from Hasselt in from Belgium.
This is The Spotlight,
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Kevin Barrett, if I may. We're looking at Iran's leader to have made a statement and blaming the U.S. and Israel in terms of the deadly riots, which he said were orchestrated and engineered in advance by both. What is your reading into what Iran's leader has said there?
Well, I think he's telling the truth, and he probably could have said it earlier based on means, motive, opportunity, and I would presume intelligence. Reports, but maybe he was waiting a little bit just to be sure. In any case, it is thunderingly obvious that this kind of activity in Iran and in so many other countries around the world that are trying to be independent sovereign nations rather than vassal states of the U.S. empire are being subverted with these kinds of activities. And I do assume that the leader has access to very detailed and accurate reports about what's been going on. But even without those, just from a big picture analysis, in the same way that we know who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline based on who tried to stop it from being built, who threatened to blow it up if a war in Ukraine should break out, who controls that part of the Baltic, and so on, we know that was the U.S. empire and its NATO military infrastructure. And likewise, based on the historical record in which the United States military and CIA has murdered about 60 million people, well, this was actually before the 9/11 war, so it's now up to pushing towards 100 million people in interventions since World War II, many of which involve destabilizing countries by fomenting chaos and then moving in. And in the old days, they used to take over the country. Now they just destroy it and turn it into an anarchic wasteland, as they've done to Libya, and they certainly destroyed Syria, although it seems to be bouncing back. So we know from historical patterns that this had to be part of this U.S. destabilization operation process that's been going on for so long. And we know that they orchestrated the attempted color revolution about, 12, 14 years ago, that so-called Green Revolution. And they orchestrate all the color revolutions. So I think the supreme leader, in a sense, is belaboring the obvious. But it's great that he's willing to say this, because it's interesting how, as the U.S. commits these crimes all over the world, how few leaders are willing to stand up and talk about it. Everybody knows the U.S. just blew up the Nord Stream pipeline and that Europe is going to starve and freeze this winter because of the United States and its declaration of war against the European Union. But all of the leaders in Europe are afraid to say that. So good that we have at least one leader in the world courageous enough to state these simple and obvious truths.
Well, Brett Yonkers, based on what our guest, Kevin Barrett, said, these are things that should be acknowledged and should be brought into the conversation, and in this case, when Iran is the topic. Now, the color revolutions on the one hand, destabilization activities on the other, that the U.S. is guilty of. It's all out there. We could talk about it, but we need a few programs to talk about it at a minimum. But what's interesting is what a former CIA official by the name of Bruce Riddell said once. He said, for years, the U.S. has been acting against Iran, and I'm going to quote him, "There's little doubt that there is a covert war underway against Iran. There are at least two players in it, the United States and Israel." So that kind of gives credence to what Iran's leader has said, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. There are numerous ways for us to know, including indeed the admissions of CIA agents or former CIA agents and American agents in general. But also, if we just look at the facts the way they are, all of this campaign and the dozens of people that have been killed in the violence that has ensued following the death of Mahsa Amini in the police custody, and the quote-unquote cause of this instability, when you see all the things that have taken place in just such a short time, you would be, you'd have to be deluded to believe that this all is a spontaneous response to the death of one woman who we know for a fact was not murdered by police. The CCTV footage is there, the video footage is there. We know she collapsed in the police station. So we know she was not touched by anyone anywhere around the time when she died. So we know that she was not killed by the police. This video footage was definitely not part of the plan of the imperialist plot when they tried to pin this on the quote-unquote morality of the police and say that she was quote-unquote murdered by the police. But what this death in and of itself was just the little spark that they needed. But we can say with absolute certainty that the violence and the instability and the terrorism that has been going on against Iran in the past weeks was pre-planned. There is no way that suddenly the death of one woman, that suddenly is the actual cause that causes Kurdish separatists, terrorists in the north of Iran to start killing people, to start committing terrorist attacks by in Balochistan, near Zahedan, by Baloch separatists and Takfiri terrorists who are active there. International protests, international manifestations trying to foment the ethnic strife in Iran and trying to break Iran apart on ethnic lines. I have seen people talk, calling for the Kurds to tear away from Iran, for the Azeris to tear away from Iran, for the Balochs to tear away from Iran. This is all pre-planned. This is all preordained already months ago. There is no way that this is a organic revolution. And it is not a revolution. It is a plan that is put into motion every so often. It has only been a couple of years ago that there was a previous round of such fomented attacks against Iran. This happens every couple of years because the plan is, the American plan, is that they want to keep trying to destabilize, and the Zionist plan as well, to destabilize Iran more.
That's
and more.
A good point.
Every try something new, hoping that it would work, and every few years they are defeated again by the forces of the Islamic Republic.
So that's a good point that he makes there, Kevin Barrett, if you can add to that, because we're not looking at just, for example, the protests that are happening in Tehran, or in many cities perhaps across the country, but we're looking at different elements that either have used the protests to ignite themselves into pre-planned execution of instability and insecurity and violence, where they're sitting back waiting for a reason to come out. Of course, in northwest Iran, the Kurds, as our guest there from Hasselt mentioned. How do you see the fact that there are different actors, destabilizing actors, waiting for opportunities to create havoc inside the Islamic Republic?
Yes, I think it's obviously centrally coordinated, as he said, and that was a very good summary, by the way. It's interesting that these protests, which are supposedly around this police brutality and hijab issue, which, of course, as it turns out, as we heard, the CCTV footage shows that this was it was not the George Floyd situation where the person was directly killed. So it's now breaking out as ethnic separatism. What does ethnic separatism have to do with this issue? Well, what it has to do with is that the CIA, which of course has been running a covert war on Iran alongside the Israeli Mossad, which has been murdering Iranian scientists, 17,000 Iranian civilians have been killed by these terrorists, mostly these MEK terrorists backed by the West now, after they were taken off the terrorist list a decade ago. And of course, many of those murders happened before that as well. So the central organization of an attempt to break up Iran along the lines of the Oded Yenon plan to balkanize the region in service to Israel is apparently underway. And both the Zionists and the American Empire have a geostrategic interest in pursuing this course. The Zionists have a much stronger one because the Islamic Republic of Iran has been the most principled opponent of Zionism and the strongest supporter of the Palestinians. And of course, that's the biggest reason why the American Empire, which is largely controlled by Zionists, has insisted on going to war, even if covert war, against the Islamic Republic since its very beginning. And the American geostrategic interest here really should be to work with the Islamic Republic. There's no reason why the U.S. needs regime change in Tehran. But the policy is dictated by the Zionists, who need endless U.S. hostility to the region. So they have this coordinated effort to destabilize the country, working with paid ethnic separatist elements and such. And so as soon as there was any excuse, they flipped the switch and set off these riots, which, again, have everything to do with a destabilization attempt and really nothing to do with the ostensible issue.
Well, this is an interesting statement coming from Iran's leader, where Brett Yonkers, he said, and I'm going to quote him, "The enemies do not want such progress to happen in the country," in reference to progress that Iran's leader mentioned happening in all sectors, which would facilitate domestic production, as he said, activation of knowledge-based companies. And he said that they want, the plot was to close universities to stop that progress, to create insecurity on the streets, and to engage in state officials with new issues. For example, as you mentioned, in northwestern and southeastern parts of the country. This is interesting because we're looking perhaps not just the JCPOA revival talks from coming into fruition, or maybe not, but really the shift that's happening. It's a geostrategic tectonic shift of Iran forces joining with Russia, China, moving towards the east, and really having this economic shift happening overall, where Iran's progress would be part of that, given the fact that this 13th administration has been so gung-ho with joining different organizations and trade blocs minus the U.S. or the West. How much validity do you see in that statement coming from Iran's leader?
I think that is an absolutely key issue to understand when you want to ask and when you want to answer the question, why now? Why must this happen now? And the reason for that is that just a couple of weeks ago, we saw what is possibly the most pivotal international geopolitical meeting that we have ever seen in our lifetime, or at least in my lifetime, which is the 22nd summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Samarkand in Uzbekistan. This was almost completely uncovered in Western media. They just didn't talk about it, but you can be absolutely sure that in the actual halls of power in the West, there was a gigantic fear about this happening, because the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is the biggest geopolitical bloc in the world. There is no economic or political power in terms of GDP, in terms of population, that and in terms of military prowess even, that is stronger than the SCO. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is not a mutual defense pact as such, but it is a pact of close mutual cooperation and in some ways also self-defense. They will cooperate against terrorism, they will cooperate against regime teams operations across their own sectarian and religious and political lines from a perspective of non-interference and anti-imperialism. And now, of course, the Samarkand summit saw the official admission, or at least the approval of the admission of the Islamic Republic of Iran into this bloc, which means we are talking about a geopolitical unit that counts Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and now Iran, as well as other member states, as its members. This is an incredibly powerful template to use for the future, and it is basically a part of the rise of Eurasia, the rise of the East, and the new Silk Roads, like have been the things that have been talked about in Russia and in Beijing for years, but it's now really coming forward. And when you see that Iran, which is such an important player in this, in the ancient Silk Roads, and then also in the possibility for the new Silk Roads and for the let's say the integration of the political sphere of Eurasia, when Iran joins this, this is a gigantic slap in the face for the American Empire and for the Zionists. And this is most likely the most important reason why they had to grab anything they could grab their hands on, in this case, the tragic death of a woman in police custody.
Sure.
Grab this in order to try to foment strife and try to potentially overthrow the Islamic Republic before the official admission of Iran into the SCO.
Thank you for that. I do have to ask you about this, Kevin Barrett, because it was very interesting how during the course of these riots, there were 9 European nationals that were arrested during these protests, in which the nationalities were from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, to name a few. But what's interesting, aside from that, is the fact that back on May 11th of this year, Iran's intelligence ministry said that it had arrested two European nationals, and upon questioning said that they had orchestrated a plot to foment chaos, social disorder, and insecurity across the country. This shows the depth, I'm looking at it, the depth of how the different countries, European countries, are involved here in this case in point, and how widespread of a plan they had, an in-depth plan they had to go ahead with the social disorder that they wanted to create. What is your reading into how far in advance they had planned this?
Oh, I'm sure that there are contingency plans for things like this that are sitting around on the shelf pretty much all the time. And then they're dusted off and set into motion when the circumstances seem right to the perpetrators. And it's interesting, as you said, that these Europeans are involved. I'm sure the reason for that is that the U.S. empire has quite a large degree of control over Europe, although it may not much longer if the Europeans wake up and notice who cut off their jugular vein and their energy supplies this winter. But for now, Europe remains fully American occupied, and the NATO people, the CIA and special forces people can work with Europeans, and those Europeans can become proxies, and then they can go into Iran and try and create this kind of havoc. It's easier for them to do it that way because I believe the Iranian services are more wary of U.S. Americans coming into Iran. I've visited Iran many times and was welcomed warmly by everybody, but I know that it's harder for ordinary Americans to do it, so they're probably working through their European vassals. And I think we also should pay attention to the Supreme Leader's statement about progress, that they don't like progress. And I think he's right. The ideology of progress in the West is that everybody has to become neoliberal and decadent, and religion has to be eliminated.
Sure.
That's their version of progress. But the Supreme Leader's version of progress, which is also the version in Moscow and Beijing, is progress means trade between sovereign equal nation states based in their own respective countries' traditions, fully sovereign states, not owned by a U.S.-based neoliberal empire. And that, I believe, is true progress, and that is what they are afraid of. So I think the Supreme Leader was absolutely right about that.
Okay. This news came out it came out an hour or so before this broadcast and this program, Brett Yonkers, and that is how Canada has imposed fresh sanctions on Iran for even the news when it came out, the way it was worded, was for alleged human rights violations, which included the death of Mahsa Amini, as the wire read. And what's interesting about this is that it actually came out and also imposed sanctions on Iran's Press TV. I'm not too sure how Press TV, in that case in point, will be included at the top of their list when you have media organizations like the BBC and Iran International, who are clearly encouraging people to come and riot, to come out and incite violence, because they show those images next to "Please come out and protest." I mean, they even said, if you're on a wheelchair, don't stay at home, come out and protest. Anyways, my question is, isn't Canada accused of human rights violations itself when it was discovered that hundreds, if not thousands, of Indigenous children were buried in mass graves, unmarked mass graves?
Yes, absolutely. And Canada is a country with an extremely bloody history in and of itself. And we're not indeed, with these residential schools, we're not talking about things that happened in the times of the Wild West or the colonization of the Americas. These are things that happened up until the 1950s and even 1960s. So we're talking about things that happened quite recently when we're talking from a historical perspective. And even if you want to do it more recently, Canada is one of the major suppliers of weaponry to countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for use against the people of Yemen, which is one of the most, or at this point, the most destructive conflict in the world. Canada, of course, plays a huge role through its significant Ukrainian diaspora, which has a significant neo-Nazi direction to it, plays a role also in supporting the Euromaidan neo-Nazi government in Kiev in their conflict against the people of the Donbas. So this is really not a country that has much right to say anything, and they should probably, you know, be quiet and fix their own problems first. But this is news to me too. The fact that they find new sanctions, or they always find fascinating, is how these people, sure, figure out new, to find even more sanctions than what they already did. I'm pretty sure the Canadian economical cooperation with the Islamic Republic of Iran is already quite negligible. So what they still find in order to sanction
Indeed.
More, it's absolutely fascinating. I think they always keep a little bit more in the bag just to be able to do more sanctions later, just so that they have the idea that they're doing something useful.
Kevin Barrett, my final question to you is, don't you think that countries should wake up who are allied with the U.S.? And the only the union that I could think of at this point, composed of the 27-member bloc, is the European Union, for example, of which the U.S. is leading them down an economic path of economic disaster, where it's basically almost leading to divisions within the EU, almost having these countries come back to the U.S. or to reinvest in the U.S., relocate their factories, that one of these days the U.S. would turn against them because the U.S. has a track record, as both you and our other guests have mentioned, color revolutions, et cetera. Aren't other countries afraid that the U.S. would turn their back against it based on their the history that it has established?
Well, yes, of course. Henry Kissinger famously said that it's dangerous to be an enemy of the U.S., but to be a friend is often fatal. And the Europeans are learning that the hard way right now. We're seeing a massive historical shift here where the U.S. is no longer even pretending to take a win-win kind of approach to its dealings with its European vassals. They have gotten the consent of the Europeans to militarily occupy Europe and essentially totally call the shots and dominate Europe now for many, many decades. But that was all under the pretense that it was a win-win situation. Europe wouldn't have to spend very much money on their militaries. They could let the U.S. worry about military affairs. Well, that period may be over now. So we're coming to a real crisis in this clash of geopolitical paradigms, the U.S. neoliberal empire attempting to crush all opposition and take over in, the entire world versus the resistance.
Thank you, Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today from Madison. Brett Jonkers, thank you, historian and journalist from Hasselt, Belgium. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitahway. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The new U.S. Defense Department plan called Civilian Harm Mitigation and Response Action Plan, which promises killing less innocent people in wars, seems to be sanitizing the brutality of American endless wars rather than announcing these interventions illegitimate. This plan tries to humanize the American wars around the world and their consequences. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. The website of Responsible Statecraft wrote, a few days ago, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin announced the completion of a civilian harm mitigation and response action plan, promising institutional changes so that American war-making kills fewer innocent people. The plan is a clear step forward in the humanization of endless war, the ethically fraught project attempt to spotlight in the book Humane, how the United States abandoned peace and reinvented war, which appeared a year ago in a paperback edition. The Pentagon commitment and the dynamics that led to it fit well with some of arguments in the book. While making American war less brutal is an uplifting project when it works, it can also function by intentional design to create a new kind of war that results in greater legitimacy. The plan is entirely open about this. It begins, the protection of civilians is a strategic priority as well as a moral imperative. Abetted by critical outsiders and sympathetic insiders who decry the brutality rather than existence of wars, humanizing war reflects ethical progress in the fighting of American war while entrenching its performance. According to Responsible Statecraft, historically humanitarian activists have been dramatizing civilian harm for decades, and with a special intensity since the so-called War on Terror began after September 11, 2001. But when the order to develop an action plan came down in January, it was clearly in response to the extraordinary Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporting led by Azmat Khan, which gave unprecedented visibility to the cost of American war-making on civilians by documenting the extraordinary levels of casualties in air strikes. As a New York Times editor observed, military officials credited the work of Azmat and other Times journalists who rigorously reported on this project as important factors in driving change. And it is, no doubt, quite an accomplishment to prompt that transformation. As the plan explains, reforms will bring more concern for harm to military culture and organization. Read carefully. The plan amounts for now to a set of promises to hire more people at a Pentagon and in combatant commands to raise consciousness in hopes of further remaking American war in the crucible of care. The plan will also provide a hub for information gathering about far-flung operations conducted across service branches. The military, it says, should even consider acknowledging the episodes when it causes too much death and injury. The overall goal is to mainstream ethical compassion in American military operations without disturbing the eternal and necessary project of putting civilians in harm's way. But while good might come of it, for sure, more is at stake in such mainstreaming. The plan is being called sweeping by Khan and other New York Times journalists and welcomed as a great leap forward. The Defense Department finally prioritizes civilians in conflict, one prominent targeting professional put it. Of course, there is a lot to be desired in the plan even before attempts to implement it get underway. A triumph of bureaucratic newspeak, there will be a center of excellence for civilian casualties. The document that announces it and spells out some of the details leaves lots of room for maneuver when it comes to follow through. And it does not seem to apply to the Central Intelligence Agency, which pioneered drone strikes and continues to conduct them, as in the recent killing of Al-Qaeda leader. The website of Common Dreams also wrote, perhaps most glaringly on its own terms, the plan says nothing about the international law governing the conduct of hostilities, and low essential rethinking the American interpretation of it clearly is. Indeed, the January press release announcing the reform process presents the United States as already operating in line with its legal obligations not to kill too many civilians on a strong foundation of compliance with the law of armed conflict. But questioning whether the reforms pan out or whether they someday come to guarantee even more humanity in warfare misses the bigger point, which is that the humanization of war can work to legitimate war, especially when it works. When it comes from the Pentagon, indeed, that is the point. As we narrate in Humane, the humanization of American war dates from the aftermath of the Vietnam War, precisely when the international law requiring humanitarian care in the conduct of hostilities took its own great leap forward. The American story has been driven from the first by the alliance of critical outsiders composed of activists, journalists, and lawyers with sympathetic insiders within government and military. Across a considerable divide, they bicker over how far to go in making ongoing war more humane against the background of ongoing American militarism, even as questions about whether, where, and how long war is fought are relegated to the margins. According to Common Dreams, outsiders focusing selectively on brutality and especially civilian harm join a growing constituency of insiders within the military that hope to redefine the warrior's honor while managing public relations in the face of atrocious excesses. There could hardly be better proof of how these two forces work together in producing a relatively more humanized form of ongoing war than the new plan. The results are a good thing if the choice is between relatively more brutal and relatively less brutal war. But from the perspective of old and new calls for restraint in starting wars or fighting them forever, that is not always the choice. Humanitarians are characteristically silent about the justice or legality of war itself, while journalists also generally restrict themselves to factual proof of atrocity even when it takes place in the midst of aggressive war. For example, the path-breaking New York Times series on civilian harm, which dealt substantially with the war against Daesh in Syria, nowhere took up that war is generally regarded as illegal as such under international law, quite apart from its civilian harm. So there is a risk that the new reforms will abet a dynamic described in the first 20 years of GWOT. Questions related to the justice, propriety, and legality of America's gargantuan military footprint were sidelined as the efforts were rendered a little less offensive in some of their human cost. The plan makes more of the same possible. And while Biden followed through on Trump's withdrawal from Afghanistan, he has re-engaged with the special forces in Somalia, where drones have also been deployed in operations. Overall, there may be less American war for the moment, leaving aside the forms of support for Ukraine. But it would be wishful thinking to conclude that any controls have been placed on the ongoing war posture, especially since Biden's move have come along with doubling down on Trump's confrontational position towards China. The Pentagon's promise of more humane war has to be put in that context. The controls that seem available concern how future wars are going to be fought, not whether a culture of restraint in fighting them at all ever takes root.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.